Welcome to the Rad Awakenings podcast. I'm Kehee. When was the last time you became aware of something deep, provocative, and uncomfortable? In these moments, we level up in our work, our creativity, and most importantly, in our own heads. Each episode, our guests will describe their Rad Awakenings. The conversations are real, raw, and will share in both struggle and joy. There's a cliched trope out there that warns against the follow your passion advice. The naysayers will say something like, what are you gonna do, leave your cushy job to start a yoga company? Well, today's guest did just that. Lauren Imperato is a straight up boss. She started her career as a sales trader on the male dominated trading floor of Morgan Stanley. She quickly put her entrepreneurial creativity to work, constantly challenging herself to add value to clients, bosses, and colleagues. As a self-described tomboy, she had avoided yoga, but as she dug into the physiology, she started to see the benefits both in mental acuity and stress management. But as is the case on Wall Street, she hid her side hustle. God forbid she get labeled as the weirdo hippie woman on the trading floor. Eventually though, the pull became too strong and she started the IMU Yoga Studio in New York that grew into Retox, a global platform of yoga, nourishment, mindset, and music. We talk in depth about the passion question and the dangers of using entrepreneurship as an avoidance tactic and running away from something. And we can both relate to the neglected narrative of entrepreneurship, the intensity of managing social media, the guilt of taking a vacation, and the constant self-doubt. I hope you enjoy this inspiring conversation with Lauren Imperato. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. Today's guest is Lauren Imperato, the founder and author of Retox. How's it going?
Hey, happy to be here.
We've got another former Wall Streeter, so this is going to be a good one. Let's start with, what did you major in?
I majored in Romance Languages and Literatures at Princeton, actually. Complete off-piste from Wall Street and the trading floor, but definitely a passion of mine.
And so you're studying, you said literature?
Spanish and Italian literature and languages.
And then the Wall Street banks come to recruit in, what, the early 2000s?
Yep.
How did you end up working on Wall Street?
You know, I always loved the concept and the idea of Wall Street and the trading floor more than anything. That idea of having to multitask and work with other people in various ways. And also, as really more than anything, to be the platform to learn how to build your own business. Because on a trading floor, in a way, every entity on there is their own mini business, particularly in where I was, which was sales and trading. That's what I wanted to do.
When did you know that?
Over time, I think, you know, when all the kids at college and friends were running around like crazy people trying to get internships at banks and consulting firms, I worked as a barista one summer. I worked at a magazine in business development and ended up writing half the articles for them. Another summer, worked for Goldman Sachs one summer, but not that summer that everybody was working. I wanted to really explore and see what I wanted to do. And through that, I realized that the trading floor was probably going to be a great place for me.
Wow. And so I contrast that with my story. When I was applying for Wall Street jobs, I didn't even know what they were. And so I was researching. Do you remember that book? Because we're from the same cohort. It was The Guide to Investment Banking. I'm forgetting the name.
I do remember that because I decided not to read it.
Oh, you did? How come?
I always think a little bit out of the box, which a lot of the people, my friends kind of look at me sometimes like, what? But then it makes sense in the long run. And I didn't dream to be an investment banking. I wanted to be either a writer, an entrepreneur, or a business owner. And I just thought that Wall Street, particularly the trading floor, would be an excellent, like, master's or schooling in that.
And so you applied to what part of the business?
I applied to almost every bank on the street, all for sales and trading in either fixed income or equities. Exclusively fixed income or equities.
And why sales and trading versus banking?
You work too hard in banking, doing too many Excel streets and PDFs, and it seemed really lame and inane, you know? No, but aside from that...
Tell us how you really feel.
Yeah, exactly. I like that idea of working with people. You know, the trading floor is a team, and there's a lot of back and forth, and it's really fast-paced, and you have to be able to multitask, and that just seemed really exciting to me.
Wow. And what product were you in?
I was in emerging markets and FX. So across sort of, Morgan Stanley renamed it 1,000 times in the 7 years I was there, but generally in that sphere.
And what was the ratio of male to females?
A lot to almost none. I mean, for a while, I was the only female, and there was generally then one other one, maybe two, maybe zero. It really depended on the group, the year. I worked in New York and London, so the city.
How did you fit into that environment?
I'm a tomboy at heart, so that was really helpful. I've always been an athlete. I can play sports. I can shoot hoops with you. I can drink my whiskey without getting loopy or, you know, inappropriate, and I can sit with you with that whiskey till 3 a.m. So in that sense, it really was useful and was fine. In another sense, it's challenging, you know, and most of the time, a lot of shit happens and you have to keep your mouth shut because maybe not today, but in the early 2000s. Yeah, exactly. And that's why it's so exciting. But in the early 2000s, even if you tried to say something, which I did try to say, didn't necessarily go in your favor. I think there was a lot of acceptance of the way the world, I'd like to say, used to work, and a lot of need to be tough. And you have to decide, you know, what you want to do, whether it's right or not, how you're going to approach, as Michelle Obama said last week in a talk I heard her give, all those little thousand cuts that you have. And do you put a Band-Aid on it? Most females are trained to or do, because that's the way up until now. It has always worked.
Yeah. What were some of the types of project and work you were doing?
So my first job on Wall Street after analyst training was in high-yield research for steel and paper companies. So
sexy.
It was awesome. So what that meant was for everybody else who hasn't had the luxury of that position, is basically I did a lot of research in Excel spreadsheets on paper companies and plastic companies in the middle of the States. Now, if you know me at all, research really is not an area that I felt really used my skill set or energy level. So I was not too pleased with being there, but did my job. Around one of the many layoffs that happened after 9/11, my direct boss got fired. And so what I decided to do was try and create a new way for myself. So I would get there even earlier than the 5:30 a.m. time, which I normally got there. And I started to do a little bit of my own research and create these little sheets, like, you know, little sheets of paper, in which I would put the name of the bond on the top of the sheet of the paper. And then I would put buy or sell underneath. And I would put pricing, what I thought was a good point to buy or sell, and literally no more than three sentences or bullet points on why. And I would drop them off, cut them in half, print them out, cut them in half, and drop them off on the seats of every trader and salesperson. And after a couple weeks of that, this one head, the head of the trading desk, actually stood up waving this piece of paper in the middle of the floor, screaming, bah, 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 wrote this thing. And I was like, oh my God. I was like 21, 22. I was like, I did. And he like called me over and I was like, oh God. And long story short, I guess my calls had been right. And so they allowed me to start shadowing on the trading and sales side. And then out of that, I got the ability to interview for jobs within fixed income, which was so cool, and started working in sales for FX, foreign exchange, and emerging markets, in which I covered Latin America and Eastern Europe and Asia, really everything from bonds to currencies to interest rates to all this stuff I'm sure nobody really cares about, and derivatives and all these things.
For our listeners who don't know what a salesperson at a Wall Street firm does, or even for my own.
So another blast from the past story, my first day in sales, my then new boss put a stack of paper, because you know, now we're talking 2002, 2003, like pre-real Google and whatnot, and not even Bloomberg was useful in the sense. And it was a stack of paper and it had people's names on it, or company names on it. And he said, find out a way to make $1 million for the firm this year. And I was like, now what am I supposed to do? So what I had to do was somehow find out phone numbers, basic, email addresses, basic, and try and meet these clients. And so once I met these clients, you want to then gain a rapport with the clients. And I never did it in a sleazy way. My rapport was by being me. So I'd either talk politics, or I'd talk food, or I'd talk actually wellness, or I'd talk wine, or I would talk travel, whatever it was, economics, I would talk to the person where I thought I needed to meet them to gain a rapport with them. From there, hopefully they became a client. And from there, again, I decided to build my business in, as a salesperson, by making my rapport with them and the firm useful on the day. So what do I mean by that? I guess if I thought that Joe really liked politics, and I knew that there was an interesting political story in Malaysia, I might go that way and from there convince him that it might be right for his in his interest to buy or sell a certain product. Where if I thought Mary really liked economics or the nitty-gritty finance, I might talk to her on that. And I really tried to create a business in which I met the people, i.e. the clients that I would then hopefully were my clients, in something that interests them and would help their success be easier and better.
You obviously had to toe the line between kind of personal connections and just adding economic value to their professional roles, right? How did those interplay?
Anybody that was my client knew I didn't take a lot of shit. And I stood my ground pretty firmly. But, you know, anything in life is a personal connection. Down to your coffee guy that knows to put the exact foam the way you like it in your triple macchiato, whatever. You know, I've always been really me. And really real. And I think that that was appreciated by people on the other side.
And so classics major, literature major, cuts out bond recommendations on chairs. And now you're managing a book of trading clients. How does your career play out for the, you know, the subsequent years that follow?
Actually, the firm sent me to London to help start off their Turkish business. So then I worked in London for a few years. And that was really great, getting to go to Istanbul and really getting to immerse myself in a culture and a people and a business at the same time. And again, you know, just to touch back on what you did say, I guess I have always been a little bit out of the box, you know, and that outlier-ness, and so I was in London doing that for a few years, came back from London and helped ignite the Brazilian business for the firm. By ignite, I mean really focusing on clients in those two countries and in those regions. You know, I speak a few languages and I like languages, so I got to pull in from, I guess, my classics, literature, education, I guess, somehow.
And how are you feeling about your career and your life at this point?
You know, I loved it. I felt like I was the luckiest girl in the world, and I still do feel like a lucky person. Wall Street, like every single industry, has its bad people and its problems. And I really, for the most part, you know, I was making good money. I liked, for the most part, the people I was working with. I didn't have to feel like I didn't act sleazily, and I didn't feel like people around me wanted me to act sleazily, which I think is really important. And I was having fun and traveling and had a great life in New York City and London. So, you know, life was great. Tired, never slept enough, but you don't even think you're tired at that age. You just keep going.
In hindsight, what do you attribute some of your success to at that?
I think that idea of being real and quick. By quick, I mean that multitasking, despite all the studies that say, I think females multitask 7,000 times a day. So multitasking is a real thing, men. And like being able to be quick, multitask, turn on a dime, and being real the whole time. You know, I felt like I never sold out while I was on Wall Street, and that's something I've tried to carry over to now. Yeah. And I think it allowed me to go to bed every night happy and fulfilled because I didn't really do anything that was against my integrity or my grain.
Yeah, yeah. And so the seedlings of something else start to get planted. You're cultivating a passion project. When and how does it enter your life?
So, like I mentioned, tomboy athlete my whole life, you know, was the captain of basketball, tennis, track, you know, Northern California state champs and all these, started the first lacrosse team in Northern California for females, and always hated yoga, mindfulness, and quote unquote nutrition or wellness. And what I didn't realize is I grew up where they were all sort of part of my life in the way that they aren't labeled as they are now. My boyfriend, now husband, suggested in 2002 when I was tired, stressed, and I'd been running a lot, or 2002, 2003 on the treadmill, he suggested I go to a yoga class. And I was making a list of reasons to break up with him. And so I added that to the con list for staying with him because I was like, does he not know who I am? Like, I'm an athlete. I'm not a yoga person. So because I wanted to make sure that I should really break up with him, again, now he's my husband, I went to a yoga class anyways to prove him wrong.
Yes.
And I got my ass kicked and I was intrigued. And I think that same thing that intrigued me is what Mentions really said earlier. It was a combination of philosophy and movement, breath and action. And being someone that has never been able to touch my toes before I really stepped into this, I was also like, wow, this is hard. Yeah. And I'm sweating. So I started to deep dive into yoga. And at this point, I was a vegetarian only because, with something I guess we'll touch on later, I was Catholic, so I wasn't looking for a religion. It was just that philosophy, let's say, or that intertwining of philosophies that intrigued me. But because I was kind of one of the only females, and it was before Lululemon even existed, yeah, you know, I couldn't be public. I didn't feel that I could be public about it on Wall Street. So I kept it entirely to myself.
Wow. So in 2003, yoga is not a big...
Not at all.
Especially not on Wall Street. Yeah.
Not at all. I mean, there was one main studio in New York versus one on every corner. Wow. There wasn't any athleisure, quote unquote, or, you know, weren't really leggings or...
When did Lululemon start for content?
I think it started like 2003-ish, okay. But in Canada. So it came down here like 2008, 2009. So... Yeah, I started really, I read like all the original texts. I studied with teachers. I never missed a yoga class 7 days a week. At the same time, I really started studying nutrition with different teachers and classes. It was pre-podcast. You had to like actually go to a class and really read a book and learn a lot about these things and meditation and mindfulness. And it was just a thing for me.
Yeah. So from that one class, you got hooked?
Well, I went back a week later because I couldn't believe, well, I faked a cramp in that first class. And walked out because all the perfect people around me were doing these perfect poses. And I was like, this is so embarrassing. And I had like my big basketball shorts on and a Nike t-shirt. And it was just like, I totally did not fit in. So I went back a week later to see, you know, if I could make it through the whole class. Did. And from there, I'd say I got hooked.
Got it. And was the mindfulness and spiritual element embedded in the yoga that you were practicing?
It was. The mindfulness, the meditation, the breath work was. The spiritual element was, oddly, through my first through months of doing that type of yoga, which, you know, were the yoga that I do now, it brought me back to my Catholicism a little bit. You know, really realizing that for the most part, a lot of religions are saying the same thing. And a lot of spiritual practices are saying the same thing. And, you know, you start, you're new in New York, you're working on Wall Street, you're out every night. You don't prioritize it as much. And by going to that yoga class, I was like, oh, these are all the things that I grew up with and went to church for every Sunday and prayed every night, you know? And so it kind of full circled it, if that makes sense.
Wow. And you're getting into it now and...
Always hiding it from everybody.
And why were you hiding it?
I really didn't want to be the one of the few or only girls on the floor and be like the yoga, weirdo yoga girl too.
Because it's before its time, but also the image of a yoga, you know, is like soft or...
Exactly. Soft, floofy, weirdo, hippie.
Yeah. Wow. And so at some point, keep walking us through.
So then obviously my friends started to realize that I, even friends and clients, you know, if I wanted to meet a client or a friend, I would never miss my yoga practice. So I'd either get up earlier and do it before I got to the trading floor between 5:30 and 6 is when I would arrive, or I would do it kind of in between the trading floor closing / we could leave and that dinner. I would like slot that in there. You know, the amount of times Morgan Stanley's office is in Times Square, the amount of times that I raced on the NR down to yoga and back, like reapplying makeup on the subway just to make sure I got my practice in. It was nuts. So my friends, I started teaching for free, sort of like begging them because I felt like I could help make them better. But I thought it was interesting to share and see if I could relay some of these things I'm learning to other people. And then the guys on the trading floor started asking me for help, you know, and that was really interesting. Like, hey, like, can you help us with our diet? Or we want to lose weight. Or I went to the doctor and they say that my liver is like having this thing. Or, you know, I really wasn't sleeping last night. Or how do I manage the stress of what happened just now as the trading day closed? And I don't think I even realized that was happening while it was happening. It really took a few years out to be like, oh, this all makes so much sense, if that makes sense.
And so you were, at that point, you were out with it and you were kind of living.
I was trying not to be like so out with it, but yeah, it was out.
It was out. And I know lots of friends who were and are on trading floors. And so they're asking you for advice on
you know,
yoga?
I think it all started the day that I so vocally rolled my eyes and scoffed that the guys on the trading floor had all done this like 30-day, it was people use the word vegan, so they use 30-day like meatless month.
Okay.
Right? And it made our job as salespeople hell because they were in such a bad mood for those 30 days. It was just miserable. So, you know, extremes. I'm not a believer in extremes.
And for those who haven't worked on a Wall Street trading desk or floor, there everything is a monthly competition.
Exactly. Like,
who can lose the most weight? Who can gain the most muscle? Who can eat the most donuts? Who can
entertain yourself?
The most saltines.
Exactly. So it was one of these monthly competitions, and it ended. And the day it ended, they literally ordered White Castle hamburgers, and for breakfast they ordered breakfast pizza, which is just so gross I'm not even gonna waste time discussing it. And it was after the breakfast pizza and the White Castle hamburgers that I was like, oh, come on guys, there is a better way than making our life miserable for a month, torturing yourself, and then going to this. And I think that's what started the me outing of it. And they saw, you know, I'd been performing well and I somehow managed the stress and whatnot, so I think it was kind of a confluence of events.
And did you feel less stress?
I mean, I feel like people, everybody these days and then is looking for less stress. What is less stress? You know, 9/11 had happened. There was a recession. Then there was like the Lehman crash. I feel like stress is stress.
Yeah, it's just like managing it.
Exactly.
Wow. And so Lehman happens. And what happens to your business unit?
Like almost everybody got fired. Wow. That was stress. I mean, those days around Lehman crashing, I think we all remember, if you were there, the stress that were those days.
Isn't your birthday around then?
Well, exactly. It was like the day of my real birthday.
I have a calendar reminder that pops up says, like, just remember that Lehman happened that day, just because, like you said, it was just this kind of surreal.
It was surreal.
Surreal and eerie and scary and...
Totally. I mean, just remember, I'm sure you remember, just sitting there in front of the screens and just watching the graphs and the phones are... They're always off the hook, but 7 billion off the hook. And then they'd go dead silence, which means you know there's panic. Yeah. Then so off the hook. And every, you know, I mean, I can still feel that in me, that feeling of those days, weeks, really. And then the layoffs came. Mm-hmm. And then the many iterations. It wasn't just one day, as we know. It was a few months of extreme
iterations.
Particularly
Morgan Stanley, hit pretty hard.
Yeah, I could say that. And I was like, oh my God, everything I've worked for is God. Yeah, so that happened all that fall, really into winter.
But you made it, you survived.
I did survive. I was pretty excited and also shocked that I survived, but very psyched that I survived.
Why do you think so?
I don't know. Maybe because I always worked hard, didn't complain, and tried to really be me and do the best job and was really honest, I thought, or tried to be as honest as I knew to be.
And so you end up...
So then it starts to be in the spring after Lehman, and particularly during the Lehman time, the guys are asking for more and more, and my clients, stress management help, you know, now they're having me pick out what they eat for lunch.
Wow.
You know, and we,
I wish
things.
You worked that hard.
Well, you know, not everybody loved it when I'm like, you know, broccoli.
Are they coming to your yoga classes?
No, now at this point, I was starting to teach fairly regularly and some people had popped into my classes on Saturdays. I was trying to keep a work-life divide, but they were coming. What are you going to do?
And were people kind of whispering like...
I hope. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, because, you know, Wall Street has such this bizarre relationship with side projects because everything's a zero-sum game. So if you spend 10% of your mind space on something else, you're being 10% less efficient on making money. And so people, I mean, I would hide mine. I wouldn't want anyone to have the, even though they were making me better at my job. Like I was researching Bitcoin in 2009. I just thought it was cool. But I would hide that because they were like, oh, he's gonna do something, or he's got one foot out the door. But so they know, but they're not.
You know, I sincerely think even when the day I quit, went in there to quit, they thought, when I said I was starting this side this business, they thought that I was doing it to help them get better. That was pretty funny.
What?
Because, you know, so before I quit, I had actually, you've worked at a big company. I filled out all these forms to say that I was creating an LLC or my own company. And I was just doing that.
Yeah.
Just, I don't know, because I'm weird and I just did it. Because maybe when I was like 40 or 50, I'm honest, exactly.
Yeah.
And even when I filled out those forms, they're like, oh, great, you're creating this company to help us perform better. So actually, I'd not thought about that, but
that's funny.
I do remember that conversation.
And so it's like the self-centeredness of the Wall Street male. But, oh, so you thought that you were going to do this, like you're retired? Like,
I thought I'd do this in my 40s.
Got it.
You know, at some point I would probably want to leave the trading floor because I probably want to become a mom. And I didn't want to necessarily miss from 5 a.m. to 6, 7 p.m., five nights a week as a mom. So maybe I would, you know, have a job that had some flexibility and supplement that with a passion and see where it goes.
But you decided to, you jumped.
I did jump. You know, I realized, because I was teaching these free classes and helping these people, and I started to realize that there wasn't really a lens for wellness that spoke to educated go-getters in the know. Yeah. You know, everybody on the floor around me and all of my friends, none of whom worked or work really on Wall Street, we all had access to education, money, internet, friends, you know, whatever it was, yet no one really knew how to keep it together. Within the context of wanting to excel at their career and their social life. You know, it's that unique balance.
And so you noticed this.
I did, because I think probably I faced those frustrations myself when I was trying to learn about this stuff in hiding, and when I was trying to figure out personally, egocentrically, how do I keep my shit together as a female on a trading floor who loves to go out, loves to eat, needs to see the clients, wants to perform well, wants to be the best, and still wants to somehow feel whole. You know, and that's where that yoga, meditation, nutrition balance, or as I say, yoga, mindfulness, and nourishment came into my life. And I realized only after people starting to ask me for it that it was something that maybe everybody else needed too.
Yeah. And did you have a vision for what the business model would look like?
Yeah. You know, I wanted, so initially the business was called I Am You.
Okay.
And the idea of I Am You.
Wait, this is why you're still there.
Yes. Oh, and even the first many years of quitting was the idea that we all have a little bit in some of us, of each other in some of us. And also, you know, why couldn't I be a girl on a trading floor who was also into yoga? You know, why couldn't I, you know, be a geek, but also an athlete? And that idea of kind of breaking those barriers down, and the idea that we're all connected as well. And so I initially started the business named as that. And the idea was first to rebrand myself, you know, meaning, I guess the word, use the rebrand now. Then it was just like, okay, become good at what you want to do, yoga, nourishment, mindfulness, educate the shizas out of yourself for that. Because I really believe in education, adding value to the platform and what you create. And then try and make a name for myself in these things that I'm studying. If I'm good and people seem to like it. So the first step was sort of like becoming Lauren Imperato off the trading floor.
Yeah.
You know, and then the next phase of the business model to me was really building up a brand that was based on yoga, nourishment, mindfulness, and music. So really a 360 approach to wellness, so that on a busy day, in a busy life that we have that's modern, you don't have to decide where to put your energies. You can come to IMU, be that digital or physical, and in that, find your solution to make you better on that day. You don't have to go to the nutrition blog and then the yoga blog and then the mindfulness blog and then the bar to hear the song. Maybe you hear it all in the same place.
Yeah. Wow. For our listeners, this is 2009. So this is before the word influencer even is a word, right? And Twitter barely exists.
I don't even
Facebook,
think it did. Barely.
None of these things really exist.
None of these things really existed. So I went so, what would be so old school now? I made postcards.
Okay.
And I would stand on street corners and hand postcards out to people to try and get people to come to the yoga studio or to, you know, spend time or private clients or nutrition or mindfulness or yoga or whatever it was. I would literally stand on corners with postcards.
Wow.
And also like put them in every coffee shop and hair salon and nail salon and bar around town. I was just like a maniac with these postcards.
And the hope was to get paying clients into one of these services, basically.
Exactly.
In your studio.
And you have to think, the internet existed, of course, but it wasn't like, and we didn't have any social media platforms really. So how else was I going to get out there?
So it was like local market strategy, basically.
Basically,
right?
Yeah, which I kind of think we're coming back to, which is what's so interesting.
Oh, interesting. And so you're doing that. So tell us about actually quitting. Like you walked into your boss's office.
That was so scary. So the
These are the worst stories.
They are. It was so frightening. The night, you know, I hadn't thought I was actually going to quit. You know, and even though I was working on building a brand for, you know, one decade from in the future, I really never thought I was actually going to quit. And then it hit me like a truck one day, like, oh God, I need to quit and I need to do this now because there's an opening now to do it. You know, I want to help these people now. And also in a business sense, there was nothing of this. And I saw a gap in the market, you know, from a brand and business perspective, that brand and business are really one now. So I worked on a speech the night before with my still same boyfriend, and it was very stressful. I think I ate like, if you know me, I can eat a whole pizza, a real New York sized pizza. It's not a problem. I definitely ate a whole one. Went in the next morning. Well, for a few days.
What were you nervous about?
Quitting.
But what about, what part of quitting?
You know, you work really hard to get that seat.
Okay.
And that seat comes with a lot of perks. Health insurance, salary, sick days, vacation days. As an entrepreneur, I mean, sick days and vacation days are very cognizant, difficult to make decisions. You know, it's kind of cushy. And you know you're sleeping 5 hours a night and you're working like a dog, but you also know that you're a lucky person to have gotten there.
I remember when I was quitting, people would always say, you can only leave Goldman, Morgan Stanley, BlackRock once. So it's like, choose wisely. You know, it's like your life might end if you give up this golden ticket. So were you stressed about the money side of things?
I was stressed about everything, you know, scared and stressed about everything. And I relieved my stress as a female. I had all these high heels under my desk because, you know, who wants to commute in high heels? So I started like slowly taking high heels out from the trading floor and in the week beforehand, just to make sure that it felt right. Okay, if you have no high heels under your desk, that means you're really quitting now.
Wow.
It sounds so lame, but I needed some sort of tangible marker.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, totally.
And no one knew I was going to quit. It really shocked everybody, except one guy next to me, the guy that sat next to me, he noticed a lot of less high heels under my desk. And the 2 days before I quit, he was like, what's going on?
Oh,
and
wow.
I told him, but otherwise no one knew.
Wow. And so you walk into some MD's office.
I walked into some MD's office, almost puked in the bathroom beforehand. My hands were so sweaty and I'd like written some cliff notes in my hands. They were like a big smear. Yeah. And I tell him I'm going to quit to start this business. And the first line was like, oh, great. So you're going to help us. And I was like, no, dude, I didn't say dude, but I'm actually quitting and leaving. And I remember his face so clearly. It was just a place of what you said, what are you doing? Why would you do this?
Yeah.
And you realize that you didn't get fired in this whole thing. So you have a pretty sweet seat people would kill for. Why are you doing that? And that conversation went on for a long time.
Did they try to counteroffer you?
Yes. And that was tough.
Yeah.
But you know, it's like a now or never. And once I think that you've checked out, I didn't want to be the person that didn't really want to be there when I knew that my heart and soul were already invested in creating this other thing. And particularly in that time, or even now, I feel like a lot of people would kill for certain jobs, and who am I to take their seat when I want to be someplace else?
Yeah. So financially, did you have runway?
So financially, I had my savings. I always say, I saved my savings on and spent on shoes and airplane tickets, but not so much that I'd run out of, that I hadn't created a savings. So that was really my idea of falling back on something.
In your mind, did you see 6 months?
I had
8 months,
so many Excel spreadsheets.
Yeah, did you model out?
I had models upon models upon, and I don't love modeling. I should say that's definitely my husband's favorite role. I made my own models in not a pink color, FYI, just normal. And I had models for the studio, models for coaching, models for this. I had it broken down to how many postcards could I hand out a month or more. Rainy day, nobody thinks about weather. And in a service industry or brand, weather's a big deal. So let's say we had a really cold winter. What do I estimate? Would I have 3 people in my first class, 5, 10, 15, 20, I had all sorts of combinations. They were all wrong, generally.
Yeah, what point did the model stop working?
As soon as I realized that weather has a bigger effect on people than it does on me. Meaning, there was just that summer was really rainy. And I was and people just, I had been sold out, but then on rainy days, people just wouldn't come as much. And I didn't get it because I'm such a person, as my friends say, I'm just me, that I would always go work out even if it was raining. I didn't, what do you mean you can't get out of the subway and get to the studio? So that definitely threw my models off a lot.
And so it starts as a yoga studio.
So I started with a yoga studio, and that was a way really to get people through the door, introduce them to the brand, to test my strategy more and really to become better at what I was offering.
And when you say brand, what were the brand assets at the beginning?
I mean, conceptually, it was yoga, nourishment, mindset, and music. From assets, I have a tea line, I've done coaching, detox with one of the first people to do really detox programs, 3-day, 7-day, 2-week, 4-week, where meals, tea, the whole menus, the whole gamut. So there's a whole different array of stuff I've done over the years. But I guess those detox programs, the tea line and the yoga, if we keep coaching out of it, were my first assets.
And then what was kind of the first big milestone that you the first big win besides the first paying client?
That's always huge. The first big win, was one I didn't even know was happening. Bloomberg wrote an article on me. So I quit May 15th.
Dude, we're both in the Bloomberg Alumni
High
Club.
High five from across the table.
I got to look up your article now.
Yeah, it came out. So I quit May 15th and in August, I believe, it came out and the title was so amazing. It was thank God. Thank you, God, for helping me out like this. It was
what's your title?
Princeton grad quits Morgan Stanley or Wall Street to teach yoga to stressed out bankers or something
like that. You want to hear mine?
Yes.
Meet Kehi, the Wall Street guru.
Love it.
It's like they're
helping.
Obviously,
us.
You had no press, PR, nothing.
No, my version of PR was those postcards and cold calling people.
And how did the actual Bloomberg reporter find you? Because it changed the game for
somebody
me.
I cold called was related to her, and that person I cold called came to the class and then told her that it was something different, and then it went like that. And it ended up being the number one read article on Bloomberg for the whole month of August.
Same here.
High five again.
Yeah, and those of you can't see us, we're separated by 7 feet of table, so there's no actual high fives happening.
But we're connecting.
We're connecting over Bloomberg stories. But same here, that story just
changes everything.
Changed everything.
It does change everything.
And for me, it was the same concept where a reporter's boyfriend was getting the newsletter and they're like, this is weird. And I think in hindsight, there's people love the I quit Wall Street on my own terms story. And she kind of like started poking around. It's like, oh, this is like a real thing. Not just like, I think when they realize you're not coming back, then they're like, let's write about you. Because then it's like a total burn. If, like,
oh,
you would go
they
back.
Were serious.
Wow. And so I said, Bloomberg writes the story.
That was a tipping point. Well, it happened really early, to be honest, especially per my wrong Excel models.
Yeah.
The studio started to be even just packed. And
off the story.
Off the story. And also press inquiries off the story. And those press inquiries lasted for a long time. And you know how press works. You know, one article leads to somebody else reading it. And maybe there was a long lead time, but maybe a year later, somebody would have read something that was based off the person that made Bloomberg. So you never really, I feel like there's no direct science for how that stuff works, but that was definitely a huge point. And then I guess another huge point was about 6 months after that in the winter, Lululemon opened their first store, definitely in New York. I don't know if in America, but in Soho. And they came to the studio, I guess, and loved the class. And they loved it so much that they put in the windows of their store on Broadway.
People doing yoga, right?
No, they put, my tagline then was deconstruct IMU, deconstruct to reconstruct. And on one huge window, they wrote deconstruct to reconstruct. And the other huge window, they wrote IMU, we love IMU. And that was in the window on Broadway's in Soho for 2 months painted in there. And what the only thing they asked me to do was do yoga in the window twice. And I said, okay, like, am I comfortable doing yoga in a window? Not really. I don't feel like I'm selling out, though, because they've now painted my business name for free in the windows.
Yeah.
I think I can suck up this hour twice to do it.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so you're driving people to the physical studio.
That was the initial point, yeah, to drive people to the physical studio.
What were the biggest setbacks at the beginning? Besides the weather thing.
In terms of getting people in or in terms of everything?
In terms of being an entrepreneur.
You know, despite the 7 jillion blogs on entrepreneurships and talks and podcasts, I don't think anybody really prepares you for it. And I think you can probably agree to part of this. There's so much more that needs to happen and does happen that anyone will ever understand. And I think that I completely, particularly in 2009, before being an entrepreneur was cool, I underestimated how much stuff there is to do and how much stuff, little stuff, takes a lot of time. Mm-hmm. And in addition, client management, meaning I had educated myself and continued to educate myself in really yoga theory, anatomy, physiology, meditation, mindfulness, Buddhism, nutrition. But nowhere did I think I needed to be prepared in terms of basic psychology. So when you work with clients, and this actually probably would be useful for our Wall Street colleagues, you know, it's like when you work with a client, no matter where they are, there's a lot of psychology back and forth that happens. And I would sit with a client one-on-one, be it for meditation, yoga, career coaching, nutrition, or in a group class. And I completely underestimated how much that psychology back and forth was happening, if that makes sense, and how they were really starting to see me, I guess, is like a teacher or a guru or something. And I didn't have any preparation for that.
Yeah. Is it the psychology of how someone might learn?
Maybe how to people come to wellness usually because they want to be better. Yeah. And they usually, for the most part, want to be better because they don't feel great and something is wrong. So initially there's this first, I don't want to call it dumping, but there's an exchange.
Yeah.
From client or student onto teacher, or in, as Bloomberg named you, guru.
Yeah.
And that exchange, I think that I was so excited to help and give that I underestimated the intensity of that exchange coming in. It's tough to put into words, but it took me a while to figure out that, whoa.
I'm surprised. I could see that in one-on-one, but even in group sessions.
Definitely.
And so you basically were internalizing a lot of your clients'
That's kind of all I did issues. For many years.
Wow. That's exhausting.
Yes.
Because I do a tiny bit of coaching. And it's so exhausting.
It's very exhausting. In fact, I started to go see a psychologist about it to learn how to manage it. You know, sort of because I really believe, again, in education and toolkits. And I was like, you know, I got to figure out how to manage this. It took me years to figure out, by the way, that it was exhausting me. And this is part of the process. But, you know, I took my day on as a Wall Street day. So I took my first private client, usually somewhere between 5 and 6 a.m. And I would teach through the morning rush. Then during the day, I would do all the million things we know we need to do as entrepreneurs. And then the evening privates would start around 5. And then there would be the group classes in the evening after that. So my day would end once you deal with cleaning, management, blah, 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 around 9:30. That's a really long day.
I think the other thing that I didn't appreciate as an entrepreneur is the context switching is so exhausting. So even if you do, like for me, I'll do 2 hours of writing and then 2 hours of coaching and then 2 hours of podcasting. That's 6 hours. But mentally, you feel like that's 10 hours because each activity is intense in its own right. And to switch like so abruptly from one to the other is just like, is exhausting.
It's exhausting. And I hadn't thought about that, but I guess what I did to try and mitigate that without even realizing is I tried to divide my days of the week in a certain way. And I did it with a really lame structure, but it would seem to be useful. So from a social platform or a content writing platform, Monday was the day for anatomy and general thoughts. Tuesday was food. Wednesday was philosophy and mindfulness. Thursday was music. And Friday was like yoga follies. And then I started to divide like Mondays would be the day in which I would think about ideas and content until I started teaching. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday were general shit show.
Yeah.
And then Fridays, I would only do a couple classes, and I would leave those days to be the days, again, to deal with back-end stuff. You can't really corral it that easily, but I tried to have some sort of structure, and Saturdays was just teaching up until 1 p.m. You have to try and create some sort of structure for yourself, I feel. What you're saying is that switching it does take some out of you.
Did you ever contemplate taking investor money?
I did, and I was offered investor money.
At what point?
Various points across the years. I didn't take any of it though, largely because I really wanted my book to come out with a good publishing house, to have to come out with Penguin Random House. And I wanted it to be clean in quotes, I'm saying from then, meaning I wanted that book to be, and everything up into that book from me. And I didn't want it to be influenced by money.
Do you think that was the right decision?
Yes, but maybe I would have been less tired.
Yeah.
But maybe not, right? Yeah. You know, who's to say? And I think that money in quotes and investor money in quotes is something that the tech entrepreneurial world strives for so much, but sometimes maybe it's better to keep it in-house.
Yeah.
Maybe then you create your voice, and particularly because I was really trying to do something so authentic and so real from me, I don't know if it would have been the right choice.
Yeah.
Maybe it would have, I don't know. I don't regret not taking it, how's that?
Yeah, did you think about the control element?
I thought about it in terms of voice and being real.
Yeah, what did your Wall Street peers, like what were they saying to you or about you?
Who knows?
In the early days?
I think at first there was the phase of I'm crazy.
Okay.
Not think, I know, because I heard, you know, and was told I'm crazy. Then there was like the phase of like, maybe she's crazy, but maybe she's gone off the deep end, you know? And then there was like the, oh, she's just like a frou-frou girl now.
Uh-huh.
And now, and then, and I'd say the last fourth or fifth of the past 8 years is really, I feel like being like, oh, she was onto something. Because, you know, when I quit, I use the phrase lifestyle brand, and I want to be at the forefront of what will be the wellness industry. Yeah. And both phrases, I just remember their faces just being like, lifestyle, what's that? Yeah. You know, brand, what's that? Like, wellness industry, ugh. You know, and now I feel like they're like, oh,
You're the straight up OG of the wellness industry.
Thank you. I'll take that as a
And how did you talk yourself down when those, I guess, backhanded compliments?
You know, it's tough. You know, I think that I internalize a lot, and there's points you're sensitive to. People kind of, there was a large phase in which people thought that I was just that like foo-foo girl, as I mentioned, and that was not easy for me. Yeah. You know, I really wanted to be like, hello, yeah. You know, I'm just focusing my entrepreneurial soul and intellectual energies in these other fields. It was tough. I don't really know, have a good answer for that. Yeah. I sweat a lot and had a lot of wine. Yeah. Does that count?
Did a lot of yoga.
Did a lot of yoga and drank a lot of wine. I don't know if that counts or not.
I tuned into your Instagram, and now, you know, 8 years later or 7 or 8 years later, you're leading yoga sessions for thousands of people around the world. Tell us about the shift from kind of solo entrepreneur studio, kind of one-on-one or small group work, to like platform in the way that we know it today, which is really social media. Because you straddled both worlds, like both paradigms.
I mean, I guess I'd mentioned in a couple different ways, because I think that there's a quite a literal platform, like as you mentioned, these classes that I've been placed upon to do things, and a social platform. You know, on the literal platform, I remember that the part of the reason I wanted to call the thing IMU at the beginning, and I did call it, because I never wanted to show my face. I didn't want it to be about me, Lauren. I wanted to be about the brand IMU and the methods that I'm offering you to be better. Like, who I am is irrelevant, I thought. Yeah. It's about what I'm offering you to be better. So if you look at the branding from the first 4 years, 3 years, I never showed my face once. And that was on purpose. Then I got asked to do a very large event, my first large event in Barcelona for a few thousand people. And a girlfriend of mine came to that, and she works in the creative spaces, and she said at the end of it, she was like, it's amazing, I was in it, you have no idea the energy, blah, 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 I have to tell you something, you're going to have to show your face. And I said, what do you mean? And she gave me this idea of like a Hollywood person, they need to show their face if they're going to get bigger, and for getting bigger for me was helping more people. So I started to play with that idea of showing who I was a little bit. So not in a bikini, not like a selfie. I don't even know if selfies existed then. I still had a BlackBerry. But showing a little bit more of who I am so people could maybe relate to this story of, I'm not trying to help you out of nowhere. I've actually suffered, and I continue to struggle and suffer and grope with and grapple with the same things you do. You know, like the subway still doesn't show up sometimes, and it's still raining and I need to get to my sweat, you know, and I still really want to eat pizza 5 days a week, 7 days a week, but I just limit it to two. You know, like we all have the same problems. So getting on that physical platform, I think, showed me that I need to switch my strategy a bit from a brand, and I needed to be a little bit still private, because my privacy and my family life is very important, but a little bit more open about where I was coming from.
Did that presumably coincided with the rise of social media, right?
Yes, which I had to learn. And, you know, I fought against, but I've done a lot of large scale events and they've each added to that social media following. And I've worked a lot in Europe before and Spain and Latin America. And so they all have that sort of like element and bit to it.
Yeah. And so as someone who is trying to figure out we're the same cohort. So we're like not the social media generation, but how did you learn how to become a social media person?
I took it the geek route. I went geeky on
You went geek.
Meaning I just read everything I could find about social media. And I did, so geeky route one is I just read. I read random articles, everything. And then you have to remember, these are early years. So now there's like so much, but I just read anything I could find. And the second thing I did was I started to study social media platforms that were successful. And I did it in a really analytical fashion. And I had a notebook and I wrote down what I thought worked, what I didn't thought work, what hashtags I saw happening. I mean, I went super old school, pen and paper, and I couldn't afford a brand. I mean, you can pay a ton of companies that do this a billion times better than I do.
A lot who don't do it better.
That's true, maybe. But I just went geeky on it. I was like, I'm going to learn as much as I can about this. I could give a about it, but it's important to my business. And I really started studying and using my analytical nature and my analytical training from Wall Street and Princeton to be like, okay, what is working in these brands? What are they all doing the same? What are these people that maybe have a better product, whatever it is, by the way, food, alcohol, influence, whatever you want to call it, but what are they all doing similarly, and I tried to combine that, those two, I'd say, yeah. the reading with the analytics, with the tangible experiences I was trying to share and having and give.
That's incredible. I think people, and we were talking about this before, when we're talking about cross-posting, blog, like the game that social media is, there's this misconception that like, oh, you like fire off a few tweets and if you're feeling frisky, you use Buffer or something, and then you sit back and you watch it go.
And it's going to explode.
Yeah, and what they don't see is, just the visual of you like going through Instagram on like a Tuesday night and being like, hashtag yoga is like check, and hashtag yoga, you know, vegan check plus.
Like, literally, I mean, that's basically what it looked like. And it was usually between the hours of 9 and 1 a.m.
Wow.
Because that was just when I felt quiet enough to do this work.
How long did it take you to really like figure it out?
I mean, I feel like it's continual, right? Because these platforms change all the time. And somebody, the guys that built my first website, that they do brand consultancy called Free Association, they told me, listen, you know, you're going to have to embrace one or two platforms, period, the end. And I was like, ugh. And, you know, and I tried to do across all platforms, but I realized also they can disappear. Like, they could literally just close Snapchat tomorrow. Yeah. So I bring Snapchat up because that doesn't feel real to who I am.
Yeah.
So knowing that these things can literally be created and disappear in a drop of whoever decision hat, and they can just shut it down, I decided to only do things that, again, felt honest and real to who I was. Mm-hmm. And so how long did it take? I mean, I feel like it's continual. But I did learn enough about the game. And it is a game.
Yeah.
And it is a trading floor, right? Yeah. There's professionals that buy and sell clicks and likes on Facebook, and it's
Look
no
at our
difference.
Election.
Yeah, it's no difference in a trading floor at all.
Yeah.
Once I realized, I decided how it really worked and the backside, the underbelly, you know, we were talking about earlier, I decided to just do my best. And there we go.
Wow. And what two did you pick?
So now I'm really focused on Instagram. And I can Instagram because one of my dream careers is to be a journalist. So I really consider my Instagram as sort of my journal. Not journal like my daily diary, but journal as in my magazine or my newspaper, where I really try, if you can look at from a business branding and marketing perspective, I feel, I don't know, you can tell me, I would hope that if one looks at it, they can get a glimpse of what the brand is very quickly without having to read anything. And hopefully also if a person who's not looking at it with a marketing branding eye looks at it, they find something that might inspire them on any given moment in time.
Mm-hmm. What intrigues me about this is that there's this constant, with this being the amazing thing you built, there's this constant, this never-ending debate about is follow your passion good advice? And the examples that are usually thrown around are, I like surfing, or I like yoga, or I like skiing. It's like, okay, do something that generates income and then siphon some of that income to spend as much time into that passion. What advice do you give to our listeners? Because I know a lot of them are cultivating side projects where there's not a clear business direction, but it's something that they love, whether it's photography, whether it's surfing, whether it's extreme sports. Like, how do you view the fusion of passion and business?
I think it's really interesting and topical. And I think the first thing I would think about that I had to think about, why do you want to quit what you're doing to do, quote unquote, your passion? Meaning, I get so many coaching clients and ask like, you know, oh, I'm going to quit my job just like you did to do this. And I'm like, oh, wait, pause.
Time out.
Time out. Let's take a big breath.
Yeah.
You know, I think that first one is a why. Why, why do you want to follow your passion? Why do you want to leave where you are? I think that's the first question. Are you escaping something that you don't like, or are you running into something that you do like? And this is one of the things I work with a lot with my clients. Is it, are you running away or are you running into? And I think that's a fundamental, critical place to start, because I think it shapes what you're going to create. So if you're fleeing something you don't like and you're only leaving because you don't like it, who's to say that whatever you do create, even if it is your passion, you are going to like? But if you really know that you're running into something that you have to create because you cannot think about anything else, or because you know that there's a need for it. Mm-hmm. And that need, by the way, isn't you being happier on a day-to-day basis. It's fulfilling another part, which I think would lead into the second point of, are you doing it for you or for somebody else?
Yeah.
Because as soon as, I mean, as you and I talked about, it's tiring to be an entrepreneur. And I think that you're one of the few people that really does understand that I've spoken to a lot of that backside that people don't talk about. And so if you're doing it just for you, and you're, if you're assuming that you're going to live off it, make money, and do a good job, you're probably going to be more tired than your other job.
Mm-hmm.
Probably.
Yeah.
I'm just going to throw that out there.
It's a gimme. I mean,
yeah. So you, it has to be something bigger than you, I think. Like, it has to be not fleeing, I think, and something bigger than you that, you know, I didn't even think about how tired I was all those years. I really didn't. You know, sometimes my husband, my mom, my friends would be like, oh, you look tired. I'd be like, no, I'm totally fine. I'm going to keep going. But because you don't even, you almost don't realize how tired you are, because the passion, not only of the thing, but of the getting the thing bigger to help more people takes over.
In that first part, what are, like, abstracted away, what are examples of something that you might be running away from versus running into?
You know, I feel like the world is so anti-corporations right now and anti-industries, yet almost everything we know and deal with is a corporation, even if it has a really pretty flower on it or a bunch of kale on it or whatever, it's probably still a corporation in some way, shape, or form. You know, and I think that people think that in structured, or let's call it old school, quote unquote, businesses, that life is bad and you're tired and you're more stressed and you have no work-life balance.
Yeah.
But I feel like, as you know, when you're an entrepreneur, all those same things happen, except that you have to say no yourself, which is harder than when somebody else is telling you not to. So I feel like there's a innate want to flood to leave that institution, but maybe the institution is the right place for you, and maybe it's not. But I do think that that merits more thought and time analyzing and soul searching than people give it credit for. And I think also there needs to be something said about the fact that once you, quote unquote, turn your passion into your passion is no longer your passion in the same way again. It is now a totally different beast. And it may or may not ever be the same again. And that's why I feel like that second point I made about it has to be bigger than you. Because if you're doing it just because you don't want to get dressed in a suit every day and you want to wear athleisure, or you want to wear your really cool kicks, by the way, whatever, we know that it needs to be something more than that, I think. Because either way, you're going to have to get in the morning and do work, I think.
So then it becomes independent of whether it's yoga or, you know, because it's just, it's bigger than the actual thing.
Because that thing shifts. You know, in Tibetan Buddhism, they talk about this idea of perception, and everything that I do with Retox is based on this, and everything I write about. Perception is the key to your reality. So you see that pen on top of your notebook, and you see something that you're going to write notes with, right? But a kid might be using it as a drumstick, and a dog might be chewing it. It's a different perception of the same thing. So your perception of perhaps following your passion is one thing, but once you are dealing with the logistics and the nitty-gritty of making money and living off your passion, your perception of it might be different. And your perception of that day-to-day life might be different. And it might be better, and it might be worse, and it might just be different. And I think that's a lot of things people are unprepared for when they try and turn, or they want to turn their passion into their career, is just knowing that life is full of challenges. You know, in Buddhism, they say life is all suffering. I don't totally agree with that, but I, you know, in that concept of challenges, it's just how they present themselves.
Wow. And so 8 years, I mean, that's
eight and a half years
in, like, pre-wellness, pre-social media. Clearly you've built something really incredible. And what next?
You know, my first book came out with Penguin. It's in a few languages now. I think that I want to write a next book, and I think it'll be a little bit about stuff we're touching on today, coincidentally. And I think that, you know, we all go through evolution. And I think my next phase will be an evolution of this phase. And not just this phase, but I think that journey of being that, you know, classics geek into a trading floor, I don't even know, person, into, I'll use your phrase, an OG in this industry and helping people. And I think there's going to be some combination of that, because I really do think that this phrase wellness and health, they're now so common in our culture that we can maybe add another iteration to it. Maybe we can peel off another layer of that onion of who we really are.
Do you think that the wellness market is saturated now?
You know, there's like a jillion more of everything every day, especially 3.5 years ago. I think that the consumer is starting to get a little weary, or wary, I should say. I think the consumer sees so many boutique classes. I mean, you just walk into like a grocery store. It doesn't even have to be a Whole Foods, a deli, and there's a wall of different quote unquote wellness drinks, and they don't even know what to get. So they're just getting, they're going back to the original vitamin water, yeah. You know? And I always look at that. If you look at the average consumer across America and the States, yeah. And they're looking at this wall, I mean, at the States and the world of just beverages, and which one do they grab? They just go back to a basic. Yeah. It's like Coca-Cola, vitamin water, regular water. And I feel like we're having a little bit of a reversion.
Uh-huh.
I think.
I literally was thinking this morning because I want to start getting back into yoga. And there are 100 options within 100 yards from where I live.
I'm sure.
And I didn't know where to even begin. And so I was like, one of the name brands is, besides IMU, is Bikram. And so it's like, well, I just know that thing was around 12 years ago. So why don't I just go back to that? So that was overwhelmed by the number of options.
And that's the exact same thing. Yeah, you're going back to what you know because it's just overwhelming.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's true from the wellness industry in terms of athleisure, food bev, concepts, boutique. I think there's always space for more.
Yeah.
But I do think that it is beginning to overwhelm the average Joe Schmo.
That the average person, has their degree of embrace or skepticism towards the industry changed in the time you've been doing this?
Oh, definitely. I think it's totally changed. I mean, from it not being an industry to becoming an industry and being mainly skeptics to total embracing to now I feel like there's a barbell between people that are sort of, I don't want to say brainwashed, but embraced times 10 and people that have gone the other direction per the yoga and the beverages, who just now are just, screw it. This costs too much money, too much time. Mm-hmm. I'm just going back to having a peanut butter and jelly sandwich or whatever it is.
Yes.
I do. I have started to see that. And I don't think that's just in New York, to be honest. I feel like that's, I mean, I don't know. I'd be curious to what you say.
I actually don't know. I do think that the skepticism, so when I approached wellness, it's a lot more about kind of the mental aspect of it. And the degree of skepticism is extremely high. And because I'm mostly in the kind of content world, basically now people dismiss 95% of the, if someone reads another article about like waking up early or taking off notifications on their phone, they're just like, I don't need to know that anymore. So I think there's definitely that skepticism there, but I do think that there is a group, and I don't know if it's definitely a group of consumers, but probably a group of companies and providers as well that are kind of established themselves as kind of the key kind of providers there. And I think that you see that bifurcation.
But, yeah, bifurcation is a good phrase. Yeah, Barbara, I feel like that's what's happening. But to your skeptics and the mind thing, I would just tell everybody that, you know, at the end of the day, your brain is a muscle. And the idea of this perception is the muscle of the mind that really controls everything. You know, like I look at my grandmother, my biggest inspiration, and she eats a loaf of bread minimum a day. She's never sick, you know, but she's so positive all the time.
Yeah.
And there is an element, a huge element, that we all read about kind of, but you know, it's much more about the other stuff still, the value of meditation, the value of the alerts, to just thinking positively and not fake positively, because we know there's very tough days.
Yeah.
But trying to switch that perception you have of things to, in a more positive direction, I think is the most valuable part of wellness.
That's an amazing way to wrap, because that is accessible to anyone.
You don't need money. You don't need time.
You don't need training.
You don't need training. You just shift it. You know, like you're getting, this happened to me last week. I was trying to get on the bus and a crazed woman was elbowing her way through and she took my spot and I got booted off the bus and I let her go in front of me because I said, you know what? Maybe she's having a worse day than I am and she really needs this bus and I can wait for the next one. And as a result, I got on the next bus and I made a new friendship actually, which never happens. And, you know, on public spaces. And now I'm a richer person for that, if that makes sense. And we just need to shift those slight interactions we have with ourselves between what we see and what we perceive.
Beautiful. Well, where can our listeners go learn all about you and Retox?
So you can go to retoxnow.com, which is the full website, and it has the offerings of the yoga classes at home, 15 minutes to an hour. It's Retox Yoga. You can go on Instagram. It's still the old school name, IMU Studio. and stay in
and
touch.
Get the book.
Oh yeah, I should have. And you should check out Retox. It's in Spanish, Portuguese, German, and English. It came out with Penguin Random House. It's at your local bookstore, also Amazon.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Laura. This has been so fun.
Thank you so much. It's been a blast.
Thank you for listening to the Rad Awakenings podcast. For more information on all things rad, including our weekly email newsletter, please visit us at radreads.co. This podcast is a labor of love and funded by the community's generosity. And if you're interested in supporting us, please join us as a patron by visiting patreon.com/radreads. And of course, leaving a 5-star review always goes a long way. Thanks again, and until next time.